Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. Books.
Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, my guest is Tom McCarthy. He's the author, most recently, of C, the letter C, published by Knopf. This novel, which was shortlisted for this year's Booker Prize, brings up provocative questions. What is the true nature of literature? Where does it come from? If we are living in a post-literate age, what is the future of literature? The novel C is a kind of historical fantasy. It uses materials, at any rate, from history, and it's about a time when 20th century technology, particularly radio waves and telegraphic waves were first taking hold. It begins the way a Dickensian novel would, you know, at an estate. You know, this really is the home of the British novel.
Yes. I mean, that's a Trojan horse, really. But it's true. I mean, I was very aware that that was the horse I needed to get into Troy, right?
Mm-hmm.
The 19th century Dickensian novel, you know, David Copperfield, Born with a Call, and so on.
And on its very first pages, there's a truck with copper
wire. With copper going through the field.
Yes. And there's a delivery, you do the pun.
there's a delivery of copper, you know, to the house in which a baby is being born. The kind of eureka moment when I realized I could, that there was a novel there to be written, I mean, this one, was when all these other concerns that I'd been kind of playing out in a more, actually within, as a visual art project that involved radio and transmission and so on, when I just saw the possibility of kind of tying them to a very clear parabola of a very conventional narrative arc from birth to death, you know.
Here's a hero. His name is Serge Carafax. You begin to giggle because this country estate seems stocked with the equipment for four or five different novels. We turn to the left and there's a silkworm interest, and we're told how silkworms make silk. We turn to the right, and there are deaf children holding hands and playing games who seem to be, there's a Rudyard Kipling short story called They, in which a person comes riding up to a mysterious estate where the souls of children go, and he hears their sounds, but he can't see them. He wrote it just after his daughter, Mary, had died. It's one of those many scenes in this first section of the book. Seems like every British novel that trembles at the edge of the terrors of empire all at the same time.
I was thinking, that on the British edition, there's acetate on the cover. There's two covers, one above the other, and the acetate level slides to produce the what you see, and the whole book is like that. I mean, that's the logic of it. That it's like four or five layers, each of which have come from somewhere else. So, for example, the silk farm that you mentioned. I read that Marconi, inventor of radio, his parents met on a silk farm. Alexander Bell, inventor of telephone, who's a big presence in the book as well, his father ran a school for the deaf, and his mother was deaf. And they would spend, him and his brothers, both of whom died, in fact, would spend lots of time tinkering around trying to invent little telecommunication devices. So all these things are kind of layered. And then there's the whole Sydney and Arcadia thing layered on top as well, kind of played out through lots of the names of, you know, Arcady Field, most obviously, but Lydium and Ellery are kind of Arcadian names. So there's, I was just trying to layer all these things one on top of the other.
Yes. So echoes, voices, traces of all the texts that precede.
Yeah.
Now, it used to be said that literature was born of other literature. And once, when I was talking to my friend and well-beloved and missed friend, Susan Sontag, she revealed in front of an audience that she derived the opening section of her novel In America from a journal entry of Kafka's, in which Kafka imagined himself at a party in Poland, and he's there. Susan imagined herself at a party in Poland among the partiers, and she said, essentially, this is literature. Lo and behold, they said, this is plagiarism. And suddenly a new American pastime was in full throttle. Suddenly, E.L. Doctorow had plagiarized from Kleist in Ragtime. We were being told that what formerly had been literature passing its way onward was now a process involving plagiarism. Of course, nonsense, but it's what happens as literature is becoming confusing to a culture. Now, in your work, this is very much a part of what you're doing, and you're not calling it plagiarism or illusion, you're calling it reenactment. What does that mean?
Reenactment. Was it Pound who said, bad writers imitate, good writers steal? Reenactment is, I guess, would be a kind of third term between originality and citation and stripping. I mean, in my books, there's a lot of, in C, I'm sure I would fail the same test that Susan Sontag failed. There are lines stripped directly from everyone from Marinetti to E.M. Forster's travelogues on Alexandria to Cavafy's poems. And I mean, we could reel off a list. And, you know, if people want to go and hunt them down and accuse me of plagiarism, they got plenty of ammunition. And this is very deliberate. This is how I understand what I understand literature to be, what Joyce called a commodious vicus of recirculation. I mean, reenactment is a complex kind of proposition. I mean, it's what my first novel, Remainder, it's the kind of central, not just theme, but kind of strategy. I mean, the hero reenacts moments from an idealized past that he kind of vaguely remembers. And I suppose you can find this logic going way back in literature. I mean, lots of Beckett's plays involve exactly the same, people reenacting something that happened in the last act. and indeed, you know, Don Quixote is a novel about reenactment. This guy feels inauthentic because he's not living like these knights do in the books he reads. So he literally reenacts. He says, I'm going to do that bit from page 271 of Don Belianos of Greece, where he charges at the giants or whatever, and he reenacts it and never quite gets it right. So I suppose, you know, the process of reenactment in general could be seen as a kind of a marker almost for a kind of literary logic of
citation.
It
seems to me so, yeah. And I would say, Tom McCarthy, author of C, published by Knopf, I would say that in the book there's a chapter that is a reinvention of Pynchon. You know, psychics and the community of spies getting together to try a seance.
Yep.
And in a way, it's a magnifying glass held up to Pynchon, because in I think, Gravity's Rainbow, scene takes a page or two.
Yeah. this one takes about 20 pages. I mean, Pynchon is a huge presence throughout the book. The parabolas of ordnance, of weaponry in the war sections, and just this general sense of an enmeshing between the human and the technological. You know, Pynchon, of course, himself is coming off a whole bunch of other writers on this subject, kind of way back to Marinetti and the Futurists, I imagine. I mean, I'm pretty sure. You know, so But yeah, no, there's a lot in C. I mean, there's one chapter that's takes place in a kind of Middle European spa on the eve of the war. That there's a blatant kind of tribute or reenactment, if you like, of Thomas Mann's The Magic Mountain, and then the first section. There's again kind of very obvious, if you recognise them, kind of Arcadian references to kind of Philip Sidney's Arcadia and
or to Twelfth Night, Illyria. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. Kind of, but filtered via Nabokov's Ada, which is again kind of recycling. I'm just interested in all these kind of billowing echoes and waves of repetition. This is how I understand literature. I mean, and what I understand, this is nothing to do with modernism. This is what literature always has been. Shakespeare is reworking Ovid, and so on and so on.
Well, that is, it seems to me, exactly true. That is what literature is. First, what is your background?
I studied literature. I come from a, I don't know, liberal arts steeped middle class family. My mum was a classicist. She'd tell us the stories of the Odyssey or the Merchant of Venice on to stop us fighting on long car journeys. You know, that's kind of
okay. Tom, settle an ongoing American argument for me. Are you allowed to not read an important classical book if you want to be literate?
No.
Thank you. Yeah. Because the war...
Is that the right answer?
That's the very right answer, because it seems to me the war being waged right now in America is a kind of war of the hodgepodge. We've now got all this detritus, all this junk around us, some of it valuable, some of it not. Will we put together something built out of the garbage? But what if it's not all garbage? And what if not knowing what we have lying around is causing us to dismiss as trash things that are infinitely precious?
Maybe a problem that can help us kind of frame all of what you've been talking about, or a lot of it, is the kind of ideology of the individual that's dominating the cultural landscape. I mean, we are unique individuals. We have a right to express ourselves, our feelings and emotions that have an absolute authenticity. This is the kind of crap you get propagated through every media channel imaginable. And it's also kind of infected our thinking about literature. Don't tell me I have to read this dead white man. I can read what I want. It's all up to me. Well, no, you know, I'm not arguing for some kind of absolute value to a particular work or other, but I think what's important is to stop thinking about individuals and start thinking about networks. Literature is a network. It always has been. And what's so exhilarating about kind of reading, let alone writing, is that you surrender any type of individuality to this kind of network, which is eternally dispersing and redispersing.
I'm talking to Tom McCarthy, author of a novel named C. As you can see, both of us are embroiled in the by now very twisted ball of yarn of literature, a ball of yarn whose twists and kinks many are attempting to solve by simply cutting the skein. Well, it's too twisted to undo.
The Borromean solution, right? Alexander is chopping the...
Yes. We bring all of this up because it's in a novel in the tradition of a novel that wants you and wants itself to know as much as possible. And there is the question, when being literate was part of being a member of a nation and a culture, it went without saying. Now the culture has to ask questions about whether the majority of its citizens have attained literacy. It's a different kind of issue. And for instance, one of my favorite guys, the German essayist and poet Hans Magnus Enzensberger, says that someday reading, careful reading, will be an art as difficult as virtuosic piano playing or ballet dancing. that it will be, he suggests, more fun because when you meet another reader, you'll be able to talk more deeply and not worry about the people who don't get it, because the people who don't get it will have flaked away years ago. It will be a subject for experts. But for me, that's heartbreaking.
I agree.
Yeah.
I just wonder if, you know, literature has been opening up more and more to other media, to other forms. One of my heroes, somebody who I think is one of the, you know, the greatest, best artists in any medium kind of operating at the moment, is David Lynch. And his films for me have a very literary logic. I mean, he cites Kafka as one of his heroes. And it clearly Kafka's legacy is at work in those films. You know, Francis Bacon is another. There's that kind of, you know, painterly visual logic. And I'm interested in that type of triangulation. I don't have this, although it's my medium, I don't really have a fetish attachment just to the word or to narrative. I mean, I get as excited by cinema or even by non-narrative forms of writing like psychoanalysis or philosophy or, you know. And then you get these figures like, you know, before we went on air, we talk about Bataille, who's someone we both love. I mean, in his writing, it's very hard to say where the philosophy ends and it becomes fiction. Derrida would be a more recent example mm-hmm. of someone who there's a kind of amorphous ambiguity between those modes. And I think it's, you know, it's kind of interesting that the project, whatever that project is, but the project of culture can be, you know, can be transferred between away from the book into something else, into cinema, into other forms of discourse, and then come back again enriched. I mean, this is not a bad thing. And if the book were, if the narrative novel were in a healthier state, perhaps that wouldn't happen so much. Mm-hmm. So,
but is there a contract? Do people have to be willing to play the game? And how do we make them willing?
I mean, I think it's almost a kind of pathology. I mean, you believe this stuff is important or you don't. And if it is, it's not a kind of, it's not for any rational reason that you believe it, like that it will make the world a better place or it will enrichen us or that it teaches us to be, any of that stuff. It is purely pathological.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking to Tom McCarthy, author most recently of C, just the letter C. We'll continue after this short break. I'm Michael Silverblatt, this is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Tom McCarthy about his marvelously complex new book, C. Although the book is filled with literary allusions, C is an adventure story that takes its hero from the end of the 19th century and through the first two decades of the 20th, when modernism and wireless technology were just taking hold. Now, in a peculiar way, right, you're no longer the average man. And America is very wary. I don't know if you have it in Britain. But a writer like this, brought up amongst us, would be, and I mean it, accused of elitism. I think Europe has a better tradition for that. What do we do when people who don't know all the literary references want to scream, elitist?
I mean, first of all, in C, the reader doesn't need to know them. I mean, it's not Finnegan's Wake. You can read it without tracking down all the references. I mean, that's kind of important. I mean, they're there if you want to pick them up. If you don't, I think it can read kind of straight up as well. But this question of elitism, I mean, this goes back and back and back. I mean, there's an interesting kind of, you know, two-direction pull within the avant-garde in general when you get figures like T.S. Eliot, say, who on the one hand was a total reactionary, hated modern life, you know, had a distaste for the scum of kind of common humanity as he saw it, and yet on the other hand was a total radical, you know, formally and in his style and in his vision. And in that sense was, I mean, not even a progressive in literary terms. I mean, a genuine radical who just ruptured apart an old order of I mean, I think he more or less invented rap and sampling in a way. So, you know.
A question. When we're talking about Marinetti and certain other figures who, since their time, have been accused probably justly of fascism. Mm-hmm. In your book, we're still with characters who say, I love war.
Yeah, we're in Marinetti County, for sure.
It's freeing me from the past. It's giving me energy and blood to work with. This is a strange avant-garde novel because it's still in love with the vitalities that gave rise to the avant-garde that formed around World War I. Do you like the liking of war?
It is a question that liberal society has never managed to answer adequately, what to do with the fact that a majority of the great modernists were card-carrying fascists. I mean, Yeats, Ezra Pound, Marinetti, you know, all the way up. I mean, Knut Hamsun, Louis Ferdinand Céline. I mean, T.S. Eliot was no liberal either, to say the very least. I mean, one kind of ignorant, rather dumb response would just be to say, well, we're not going to read them because they're horrible, you know. The more common response is to try and separate out the genius of the work from the horribleness of the kind of political affiliation. I don't think that works either. I mean, I think really we have to understand that the early 20th century was an extremely dynamic time in culture, and lots of that dynamism came from or was associated with the right, and lots of it was associated with the left. Marinetti started out on the far left and moved to the far right, and he hardly had to change anything to shift from one position to another. So you know, and paradoxically, there are as many, I mean, this is why something like Marinetti is not just propaganda for kind of militarism. I mean, it's much more interesting than that. It's fraught, like all great art, it's fraught with contradictions.
Well, your young man, Serge, goes off to war, to World War I, and he makes me think of another young man in a different environment after World War II, a young man who appears in comic books, graphic novels, a young man named Tintin who has a dog named Snowy. Tintin is a child detective, essentially, a child reporter, who's living in an age in which truth has bailed out. And like your novel, C, I would say what we have left is the ability to try to make staggeringly beautiful entertainments out of the prisons and ruins of the cultures that rapidly are falling all around us. Would you approve of such a description of your novel?
Tintin is a very interesting character for me because, you know, you mentioned Pynchon earlier. I mean, there's something kind of Slothrop-like about Tintin.
Slothrop is the hero of Gravity's Rainbow.
I mean, he's a kind of void. He's just this blank who acts as a kind of prism in which the light of an era is kind of reflected and concentrated. I mean, Tintin has no, I mean, even more than Slothrop, he has no past, he has no family history, and yet the Tintin books involve and seen as one kind of ongoing kind of oeuvre. They involved a very, very layered and elaborate family saga being played out. And they move between the high bourgeois, almost aristocratic house in Europe of Captain Haddock, which has its own crypt and its own buried secrets held within it, on the one hand, and on the other hand, the pyramids and crypts of the ancients, of the Egyptians and the Incas. And what usually leads from one to the other, again and again throughout the adventures, is radio, wireless transmissions. Tintin is meant to be a journalist, but he never files copy. What he does repeatedly is tune into and track down illicit transmissions. So that was, yeah, that was very much, I mean, not at the back of my mind, at the front of my mind while I was writing C. I mean, Serge, the main character, like Tintin, is kind of neutral. He's almost a blank. It's like a cipher. He's a space through which everything else, or in which everything else, surges. and I suppose, yeah, that kind of, you know, having what on the surface is a quite conventional adventure narrative going on. I mean, he flies planes, he crashes, he digs up pyramids.
He has sex.
He has sex, unlike Tintin. He actually has sex.
Within pyramids, in sarcophagi.
Exactly.
Among the bones and detritus of ruined cultures.
Exactly, these kind of orgies with all the dead.
And if you will permit me to return to the diction of that British novel from which this all depends, it is my dearest hope that among the lost and ruined transmissions of a radio culture, that those like this conversation with you, Tom McCarthy, will last and be found and explain, will disencode the moments of a present that becomes constantly more staggeringly incomprehensible. Thank you very much for joining
pleasure.
Me. I've been talking with Tom McCarthy, author most recently of C, published by Knopf. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from C at kcrw.com/bookworm. You can podcast this program, share it with a friend, or embed it on your blog with a click of a button on our media player at kcrw.com. My co-producer is Melinda Siegel. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcast the most recent ones at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. And we're just read this, I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.